from deep inside your radio.
At the sound of that tone, it was straight up top of the hour, U.S. Naval Observatory time, observing your navel since 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, this is New Orleans, and it's New Orleans in the run-up to the Super Bowl game, which is being played in this very city. And it resembles nothing so much as London in the run-up to the Olympics. Hey, we better fix the place up. Company's coming. So, yes, all the streets are being ripped up right now. But they'll be looking great for you if you're coming to town for the Super Bowl. And then they'll be, you know, ripped up again. To make them like they used to be, I think. I think that's the plan. Anyway, nothing beats being in two cities where they're trying to fix it up for visitors. Remind me not to do that again. The Sunday Morning Yak shows today, somebody tweeted that they were more almost immeasurably intractable and not worth watching than usual. Hard to say. High bar. But there was one of them where the host, I think it was on Fox News. Yes, sometimes. Where John Roberts, who used to be on CBS and is a Canadian, so there, asked his two guests, one a Republican and one a Democrat, because, you know, we welcome all views. And they're arguing about the debt, you know, the usual crap, the debt ceiling and the thing and the deficit and the thing. And if you're wondering why I call it the usual crap, check out the interview in October with Stephanie Kelton on this broadcast. The transcript is at harryshearer.com on the show page. Anyway, they're wrangling and talking over each other and yelling, you know, the lovely stuff that they do, because it's Washington, and there ain't no cherry blossoms yet, so they got to do something. And he finally says, John Roberts does, is there anything the two of you agree on? And they said, yes, we got to get this thing solved, this debt and deficit, we got to get it solved. Which was a glaring omission, not noticed by the host of the program, because there's something else that they, Democrats and Republicans, agreed on during the fiscal cliff negotiations, where it all seemed so contentious and diametrical. They both agreed on giving tax breaks to certain favored businesses in the fiscal cliff deal. You probably have read this now. NASCAR got a break, got a tax break. The film industry, God love them, got a tax break. To make bigger fake guns, I guess. Just a nice little list. It all went into a bill that was put together by a bipartisan coalition in the Senate way last August. Just in case. And then, what do you know? It gets folded into the fiscal cliff deal in the last minute. Just ipso facto, presto changeo. So, yes, there is something that two parties do agree on. Tax breaks for their friends. Don't tell Fox News. Perhaps the most remarkable sentences written this week come from a U.S. judge. Oddly enough. But sometimes, you know, even U.S. judges have had a snootful. Such was the case with Colleen McMahon, federal judge in New York, who rejected an attempt by the New York Times to make public, via lawsuit, the criteria by which the president and his administration decide whom they will kill in targeted drone attacks. McMahon, as I said, rejected the lawsuit, the attempt by the New York Times to make this stuff public. But, and here is where we now quote federal judge Colleen McMahon, quote, "But after careful and extensive consideration, I find myself stuck in a paradoxical situation in which I cannot solve a problem because of contradictory constraints and rules, a veritable catch-22. I can find no way around the thicket of laws and precedents that effectively allow the executive branch of our government to proclaim as perfectly lawful certain actions that seem on their face incompatible with our Constitution and laws, while keeping reasons for their conclusions a secret," unquote. Federal Judge Colleen McMahon writing about her snootful. Hello, welcome to the show.
sad and lonely all the time. That's because I've got a war in mind. You see, the world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. Everywhere. Just read your paper and you see just exactly what keeps worrying me. You see, the world is in an uproar, and the danger zone is everywhere, everywhere. My love for the world is like always, and the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of all the progress that's being made toward eternity, eternity. Every morning and every night finds me hoping that everything is all right. You see, the world is in an uproar, and the danger zone is everywhere, everywhere. My love for the world is just like always, and the world is a part of me. Yes, it is. And that's why I'm so afraid of the progress that's being made through all eternity, eternity. Every morning and every night finds me hoping that everything is all right. You see, the world is in an uproar, and the danger zone is everywhere.
From the shores of Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, spitting distance from Lake Pontchartrain. Don't spit into the lake, please. It's high enough, water level's high enough already. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And yeah, the same guy that denounced the Bush administration for keeping the torture memos secret, made them public when he became president. now is saying, no, the legal justification for the drone killings, you can't make those public. Now, you see, if it was politics, people would call that flip-flop, but I think it's just comedy. It's just a wonderful switcheroo. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? The award-winning news of the warm, don't you know?
Soft listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Shh. Listen to the warm. Oh, sorry. I was doing Rod. A new study by scientists from the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow, and Landscape Research and from the École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, you're welcome, describes for the first time what lies behind a change in vegetation, explaining why vascular plants are at an advantage over peat mosses in a warmer climate. The research team closely monitored 4 peat sites at various altitudes over a period of 3 years. The selected altitudes reflect the expected changes in climate conditions for the year 2050 in northern Switzerland. They observed that the increase of shrub cover and soil temperature along the additional altitudes were responsible for a decrease of almost 50% in the production of new litter by peat mosses. They are the main contributors to peat accumulation. Why all this bother about peat? Why all this repeat, for that matter? The analysis showed that vascular plants can increase the availability of soil nitrogen by means of specific compounds contained in their leaves. They exploit the nutrient for their growth, a process that becomes more and more frequent when soil temperature increases. At the same time, with higher soil temperature, these vascular plants release a greater amount of organic matter into the soil through their roots, and this stimulates the decomposition activity of soil microbes. As fewer peat mosses grow, there will be less new peat to store atmospheric carbon. That's the point of the thing. In addition, the increased decomposition activity of soil microbes accelerates the decomposition of old peat. You remember him. He used to hang out at the store. Thus, carbon that might otherwise be kept in storage for millennia by peat can be released into the atmosphere. The situation casts a shadow on the capacity of peatlands to continue to accumulate atmospheric carbon. As a consequence, peatlands can turn from carbon sinks to carbon sources, thus intensifying the climate warming instead of contributing to reducing it. Peatlands cover only 3% of the world's surface. They store about 30% of all soil organic matter, an amount equivalent to about half the atmospheric CO2. On a global scale, peatlands stock an amount of carbon which is twice the carbon stock of all forests. In this sense, peatlands can be considered hotspots of carbon accumulation. They've contributed over millennia to cool the climate by retrieving greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So, maybe not for much longer. Say goodbye to peat. Some 40 million people depend on the Colorado River Basin here in this country for water, but warmer weather from rising greenhouse gas levels and a growing population may signal water shortages ahead. In a new study in Nature Climate Change, climate modelers at Columbia University predict a 10% drop in the Colorado River's flow in the next few decades. So California and Arizona will be arming themselves for the battle. That will disrupt long-time water-sharing agreements between farms and cities across the American Southwest, from Denver to Los Angeles to Tucson and through California's Imperial Valley. Maybe they'll stop growing cotton and rice in the driest part of California. You think No, that's not from Colorado River water, I don't think. That's not what irrigates that. But still, cotton and rice, the two most water-hungry crops in, I think, agricultural cultivation, grown in the most water-hungry Central Valley of California. Nutty, right? It may not sound like a phenomenally large amount, except the water and the river is already over-allocated, says Richard Seeger, a climate scientist at Columbia. His study expands on findings published 5 years ago in the journal Science that the American Southwest is becoming more arid as temperatures rise and rainfall patterns shift due, they say, to human-caused climate change. It also comes on the heels of a major study of the Colorado River Basin by the U.S. Department of Interior that projected longer and more severe droughts by 2060. 2060, like we're going to be around in 2060, and a 9% decline in the flow of the Colorado. The projections are spot on, says Bradley Udall. Yet another Udall. They're breeding them. An expert on hydrology and policy of the American West at the University of Colorado Boulder, UCB. Everyone wondered what the next generations of models would say. I wonder how they look. Now we have a study that suggests we better take seriously the drying projections ahead. Drying is expected in all three regions of the Colorado, the headwaters, the California-Nevada region, or Calneva, as Frank Sinatra used to call it, and Texas. As I say, drying expected in all three regions as warmer temperatures trigger more evaporation, even in places that may see greater seasonal rain or snowfall, according to the study. So build that big cistern now. Population growth in the Southwest is putting added pressure on regional water resources. To put the Colorado flow projections in context, a 10% decline is about five times the amount of water that Vegas uses in a year. And the water that Vegas uses stays in Vegas. With alternate water sources tapped out, the West will likely have to meet the decline by cutting back on water use. You can't go build another water project, Udall said. That's what makes this problem so difficult. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, what the frack? No. I take it back. Well, yeah, what the frack? Why not? Here it is. Scientists are once again reporting alarmingly high methane emissions from an oil and gas field, underscoring questions about the environmental benefits of the natural gas boom here in the United States. This according to Nature News, which publishes... Yes, News of Nature. The researchers who held joint appointments with NOAA and the University of Colorado in Boulder... Wow, there's that UCB again. First sparked concern last February with a study suggesting that up to 4% of the methane produced at a field near Denver was escaping into the atmosphere. Methane, as you know, is a potent greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. If it's leaking from fields across the country at similar rates, it could be offsetting the climate benefit of the shift from coal to gas, you see. Industry officials and some scientists contested that claim last year, but at an American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco last month, the research team reported new Colorado data that support the earlier work, as well as preliminary results from a field study in Utah, suggesting even higher rates of methane leakage, an eye-popping 9% of the total production. Are your eyes popping? Put them back in. Come on. That figure is nearly double the cumulative loss rates estimated from industry data. We were expecting to see high methane levels, but I don't think anybody really comprehended the true magnitude of what we would see, says Colm Sweeney, who led the aerial component of the study for NOAA. Whether the high leakage rates claimed in Colorado and Utah are typical across the U.S. natural gas industry remains unclear. Boom may be a bane. And it's found that high concentrations of salts, including radium and barium salts, are present in the flowback waters from fracking operations, leading to fears over potential groundwater contamination. This is from oilprice.com. The amounts of the various salts are greater than those in the mysterious fluids used in the fracking operation, fracking, the hydraulic fracturing of shale to get natural gas out, and their specific concentrations are consistent with having arisen from an underground aquifer set down during the Paleozoic era. You know, when Larry King was young? Fracking, as we explained. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania analyzed samples taken principally from four different sources. Brines recovered from 40 conventional oil and gas wells in Pennsylvania, flowback waters from shale wells, fracking wells, two more samples of shale wells and similar waters from eight horizontal wells. The results showed that flowback waters from the fracking contained a very high degree of salinity, inconsistent with the concentrations of salts contained in the waters used for the fracking, the weird water chemical mixture used, and it's proprietary, don't ask what it is, used in fracking. Rather, it appears these additional elements stem from the Paleozoic era, which was the earliest of three geologic eras of the Phanerozoic eon, lasting from about 541 to 252 million years. BP, before BP, I guess, or for Christians, 4,800 years ago. The Paleozoic is divided into six geologic periods, including the Cambrian and the Devonian, the ones you, and the Permian. We've heard of those. The Paleozoic was a period of dramatic geological climate and evolutionary change. Specifically, the study examined fluids that were brought to the surface within 90 days of fracking. It contained a high range of elements, high amounts of a range of elements, most disturbingly radium and barium, which were washed up from some 8,000 feet below the surface. This might appear to run counter to the view that groundwater contamination is impossible because of the great depths at which fracking is done, and it's well below the water table. This investigation raises the issue not over the corrosive salts and benzene that are in the fracking fluid to begin with, but over the exhumation of other toxic materials previously sequestered in the rock over millions of years. The measured levels of radium and barium are significantly greater than those deemed acceptable in drinking water, so learn to find barium and radium acceptable, won't you? Thank you. And so the necessity to dispose properly of the waters from fracking operations is now of a higher possible priority. Account should be taken of the kinds of materials that may be washed up from deep underground. Who's washed up? Oh, sorry. As well as the intrinsic composition of the fracking fluid. If the waters are disposed of incautiously, there may be a real risk of water supplies becoming contaminated by substances that are naturally occurring, but nonetheless highly dangerous. Professor Chris Rhodes writing in oilprice.com. Isn't that nutty? The Paleozoic, ladies and gentlemen, sending a love message to us. Just like, you know, just like we will. With our nuclear waste, but more about that in a moment. In the meantime, news from outside the bubble. First of all, from the Guardian newspaper in London, these are both, well, one of them is about a set of words missing from a British prime minister, similar to the words missing from that Sunday Morning Yak Show. David Cameron, the British prime minister, has pledged to make, quote, damn sure, unquote, that Starbucks and other multinationals found to be legally avoiding paying taxes in Britain pay their fair share in the future. We talked about this issue back when I was in London. Prime minister accused Starbucks, Amazon, and Google of lacking, quote, moral scruples, unquote, by seeking ways to minimize their tax payments to the government. These comments were made to business leaders and young entrepreneurs weeks after the Parliament accused the three companies of immorally minimizing their UK tax bills by using secretive jurisdictions and complex royalty payment structures. We've got to crack that, Cameron said in response to a businessman's question. I want to make damn sure that those companies pay it. It's simply not fair or not right what some of them are doing by saying, I've got lots of sales here in the UK, but I'm going to pay a sort of royalty fee to another company that I own in another country that has some special tax dispensation, unquote. Cameron claimed he was going to put tax avoidance right at the top of the agenda of the UK's presidency of the G8 group of leading economies. I'm chairing the G8 this year, so I'm going to be getting the Americans and the French and the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese all to look at this together, how we can try and stop unfair tax farming practices. Cameron said some companies had told him their really aggressive tax avoidance, quote, was all within the law. Well, actually, there are a lot of things that are within the law, he said, but we don't do because actually we have some moral scruples about them. And I think we need this debate about tax too, unquote. Notice he never said they should change the law. Just moral scruples. From The Guardian, Britain and other European countries must use the money saved by withdrawing from Afghanistan to re-equip their military and help reverse worrying cuts in defense spending. Who says that? The American ambassador to NATO. Ivo Dalder. Yes, he's an American. Says if Europe did not invest in new military capabilities, its over-reliance on America would continue at a time when Washington has made the Far East and China our new strategic priority. If we don't start soon in investing in those capabilities, then the gap between the U.S. and the rest is going to grow, and if it is bad now, they will be worse. UK and the U.S. are preparing, as you know, to withdraw thousands of troops from Afghanistan. Cameron announced 2 weeks ago that 3,800 Brits will withdraw from Afghanistan in the next 12 months, hinted the total could be higher. The defense budget in Britain has been under huge strain, given the pressure for spending cuts that have fueled, so far, a double-dip recession in Britain. Treasury officials have privately urged the Prime Minister to speed up the withdrawal from Afghanistan to cut costs. See, ultimately, yes, it does come down to money. Dalder, however, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, believes NATO allies should plow these savings back into military equipment that is urgently needed. He said last year's Libya campaign had shown NATO was capable of reacting quickly and effectively to a crisis, but warned it had also exposed worrisome trends in Europe's ability to act without relying heavily on U.S. help. If this is not addressed, he warned, NATO would not be able to undertake a Libya-style campaign again in 10 years' time. Oh, no. What then for Europe? He revealed U.S. had sold some advanced munitions to NATO during the Libya campaign because European stockpiles were running out. Thank God the U.S. sells arms to NATO. Could that be at the basis of what he's recommending? It did demonstrate, he said, the Libya campaign, that stocks of equipment had run out and that people were not investing sufficiently to have these capabilities. Countries withdrawing from Afghanistan, he says, should not use the peace dividend to spend on other parts of their budgets. It should be retained and be reinvested in re-equipping the force, investing in new capabilities. What we don't want to see is we take those savings and pump them into other parts of the budget. I guess that's you and me, ladies and gentlemen. He's speaking for us. We would like those savings to be reinvested in real capabilities. You know, not like schools and hospitals. Real capabilities. Because in part, the expenditure in Afghanistan has come at the cost of procuring new capabilities. Oh, really? I see. Afghanistan cost... Yeah. Dalder's remarks reflect concern in the U.S. that Europe cannot wean itself off American military help. The White House wants Europe to shoulder more of the burden to keep NATO robust. Dalder said the lack of munitions for the air campaign over Libya was a signal there's a lack of investment in critical core capabilities by the alliance. Not whether we can start a conflict, but whether we can sustain a large-scale conflict over time. That's what's now on the agenda, says the U.S. ambassador to NATO. Priorities. Okay. We have to re-equip. I mean, sorry, the Europeans have to re-equip because otherwise, what the hell is going to happen? We will never be able to do another Libya. There'll never be another Libya. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. And I share this with the group. I had a certain amount of apprehension that the host of this broadcast was being played for a bit of a joke here. But apparently this is all real. But I give you that disclaimer in advance in case it turns out tomorrow or Tuesday that this didn't turn out to be real. I have my doubts, but still, it's from a weekly newspaper in Colorado. No, sorry, in Illinois. Illinois Times. Checked it out. It exists. It's real. The story appeared in it. So I share it with you in this week's News of the Godly. The pastor of St. Aloysius Church on Springfield's North End has been granted a leave of absence after he called 911 from the rectory. Here now, published by the newspaper, is the tape of that call.
Hi there. I am stuck in a pair of handcuffs. I'm going to need help getting out before this becomes a medical emergency.
What's the problem?
I am stuck in a pair of handcuffs.
You're stuck in a pair of handcuffs?
Yes, playing with them. So I need some help getting out.
Okay. What's the address where you're at?
2119 North 20th.
Your name? Okay. Is this a business you're at?
It is actually, yes.
Okay, what's the business?
Hey, this is.
Okay. Where at in the building are you?
I'm in the front room. Come to the front door.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to get help over there for you, okay?
Okay, I'll be here.
Are you an employee there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, are you the only one there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'll be there.
All right, we'll get somebody over there, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Uh-huh.
That's Father Tom Donovan speaking to the 911 dispatcher. In case you noticed some impediment to his diction, police discovered some sort of gag on the priest when they arrived. The diocese has been tight-lipped about the matter, if not gagged, saying only that Bishop Thomas Poprowski granted Donovan's request for a leave of absence at some point before Christmas. The diocese knows about the incident, given that an attorney for the diocese was given the copy of the 911 tape. A spokeswoman for the diocese said that the diocese also has a copy of a police report on the matter. The spokeswoman would not discuss or disclose the pastor's whereabouts or say whether he's staying at a church-affiliated location. Donovan apparently approached the bishop after the incident and asked for help. He came to the bishop before anyone was aware of the incident, said the spokeswoman. He came to the bishop and asked for help, and we granted leave. The police account jibed with what the pastor told the bishop.
I was playing with handcuffs.
News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. They just get godlier. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now... And now a little drum fill for your listening pleasure. But here is what it should have been. Cymbals, not drums.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie, Happy New Year.
It's always the same to me. Always just another year.
Well, it's a heartwarming view of life itself in the modern world. Addie, our friend the Atom, here as we share with you news of the Atom.
I'm excited. A whole new year of news about the Atom.
Yeah, it is exciting. First off, cleanup crews in Fuke province. Prefecture, they call it in Japan, have dumped soil and leaves contaminated with radioactive fallout into rivers. Water sprayed on contaminated buildings has been allowed to drain back into the environment, and supervisors have instructed workers to ignore rules on proper collection and disposal of the radioactive waste.
Aside from that, it sounds good.
Decontamination is considered a crucial process in enabling thousands of evacuees to return to their homes, says Asahi Shimbun. But the decontamination work witnessed by a team of reporters from the paper shows that contractual rules with the Environment Ministry have been regularly and blatantly ignored, and in some cases could violate environmental laws.
But they're just environmental laws. They're not real laws.
If the reports are true, it would be extremely regrettable, said the governor of the prefecture, Yuhei Sato. I hope everyone involved will clearly understand how important decontamination is to the people of Fukushima. He called on the Environment Ministry to investigate and present a clear report to the government. The shoddy practices may also raise questions about the decontamination program itself and the huge amounts of money being pumped into the program. Initially, $7.4 billion to decontaminate areas hit by radioactive substances from the Fuke thing. Work has already begun informing municipalities to remove radioactive substances from areas within 20 meters of buildings, roads, and farmland. The Environment Ministry itself doesn't have the know-how, so it's given contracts to joint ventures led by major construction companies to do the work. In signing the contracts, the Environment Ministry established work rules requiring the companies to place all collected soil and leaves into bags to ensure the radioactive material wouldn't spread further. The roofs and walls of homes need to be wiped by hand or brushes. The use of pressurized sprayers is limited to gutters to avoid the spread of contaminated water. But during December, four Asahi reporters spent 130 hours observing work at various locations. At 13, workers were seen simply dumping collected soil and leaves as well as water used for cleaning rather than securing them for proper disposal. Photos were taken. The reporters also talked about 20 workers who said they were following the instructions of employees of the contracted companies or their subcontractors in dumping the materials. A common response of the workers was their decontamination work could never be completed if they adhered to the rules.
Can't argue with that.
Nearly 4 years after its expected completion date, a processing plant that's vital to cleaning up deadly nuclear waste near Aiken, South Carolina, is only 65% finished and hundreds of millions of dollars in the red. The Savannah River Salt Waste Processing Plant originally was scheduled for completion in 2009, but problems with its design and the types of materials needed in the facility have delayed work and sent costs skyrocketing. Early U.S. Department of Energy estimates placed the prospect.
Are you having trouble?
Yeah. Placed the project's cost at $440 million. The cost later was revised to $900 million. Today, it's risen to $1.3 billion. But delays in the project are also a concern to the public for environmental and safety reasons. Without the salt waste processing facility, efforts to clean up some of the world's most dangerous atomic waste could be delayed.
It decays.
The Cold War weapons buildup at Savannah River left a legacy of dangerous atomic waste, and site managers are now working to clean up the toxic mess. The most dangerous waste sits in 47 aging tanks that are prone to leaks.
Hey, who isn't?
Managers say the salt waste plant likely will not open until at least 2018, 9 years after its initial target date for completion, although that date is tentative and could be pushed back.
Tell me more about Fook.
Okay. First request from Addie. In one of the first estimates of when Fook evacuees may return to their homes, the mayor of one nearby town is telling former residents it could be 20 years away. He said 30 years is a realistic goal because that's roughly the half-life of radioactive cesium-137. The mayor said he would call on the central government and on TEPCO to carry out thorough decontamination work. We just heard about how thorough it is. And he would dedicate those 30 years to improving living conditions for evacuated residents, he said. The central government, though, has made no promises about the return of people who were forced to flee from highly contaminated areas, despite evacuees voicing frustration at being left in limbo. Tom?
Left in limbo.
Right. Have you met Addie?
Pleasure.
Same here.
News of our friend the Atom, as the evacuees are left at the point of no return.
You know that once upon a time, I didn't need you so. It would have been so easy then for me to turn and go. But now there's no leaving you. I know that for a fact. I'm at the point of no return, and for me there'll be no turning back. I told myself you'd always be a habit I could break. But now a day without your kiss would be so hard to take. You just can't get off a train that's moving down the track. I'm at the point of no return, and for me there'll be no turning back. Once I could have said goodbye, but that was at the start. Now I think I'd rather die than be the one to say we'll part. Maybe you will break my heart, or maybe you'll be true. No matter what the future brings, I've got to see it through. Maybe your love for me is nothing but an act. I'm at the point of no return, and for me there'll be no turning back.
me, there'll be no turning back.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show with Follow the Dollar. Following the dollar leads us here. President Obama will accept unlimited corporate donations for his inauguration this month, reversing his position from his first inauguration, according to two sources talking to Politico. It's not a flip-flop, it's a switcheroo. There are no legal limits for inauguration deductions, but 4 years ago, the president capped all contributions at $50,000 and barred companies from kicking in any money. But the sources say the new decision is driven by pragmatism. The president and his team just wrapped up the most expensive campaign in history. Costs topped $1 billion. And they've determined that their donors are simply tapped out. The committee will not accept money from lobbyists or PACs. And they said the identity of all contributors and the amounts they give will be disclosed regularly on the committee website. This isn't the president's first reversal from a previous stance on contributions after nearly 2 years of blasting super PACs. He announced he wouldn't mind his supporters this last February writing multi-million-dollar checks to super PACs. Previous presidents, of course, accepted large corporate contributions. Now, this one will, too.
I'd hate to call you a liar.
Father Knows Best.
Miss Kitten, through with homework already?
No, Manuelo, they don't start up homework again until after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Oh, I'm not surprised. Take until then just to say the name of the holiday.
Oh, now don't you be disrespecting 3/4 of my heritage.
I'm just teasing you, Miss Kitten. But I can't talk now. We've got a big dinner happening tonight.
Oh, not another one. It seems like I only get to have regular dinner with Mom and Dad 4 or 5 times a week now. So, who do I have to be nice to tonight?
Oh, I don't know the name, Miss Kitten. All I know is he must be very important.
Oh, you're using the good china?
We are using the imported wine.
Really?
Oh, yes. Half my crew are back there. Slapping California labels on the bottles right now.
So, basically, you figure you'll get around the Chinese censorship with your new mobile platform?
Well, we may not get around the censorship, but at least we'll be selling ads over there.
Oh, don't be too evil, huh?
Well, don't be too evil for too long, I guess. By the way, Madam First Lady, mm-hmm. My compliments on the wine. Oh. This is from Napa?
That's what the bottle says. And you can call me Michelle. After all, I think we're sitting together at the Platinum Inaugural Ball.
Oh, and thanks for your contribution, Eric. Makes a difference.
Well, if $2 million didn't make a difference, the Federal Reserve should start re-inking their printing presses.
Daddy?
Just a second, Kevin. Daddy's talking business.
You mean the people's business?
Oh, you got her trained right. Soon she'll be writing your speeches.
Hey, soon enough she'll be giving them. So, if you need any help with the EU people on the antitrust stuff, obviously I have no pull with the guys over at the Justice Department.
Obviously.
But I will sit here and wish very hard on your behalf.
Honey, your daughter really wants a word with you.
Oh, sure. What is it, Cupcake?
Daddy, remember when I was back in first grade?
Absolutely. That was first election in the first 6 months of first term. That was big.
And right after Christmas, you took Princess and me to lunch, and a man from Microsoft came up and offered you a check for your inaugural ball, and you refused it.
Oh, sure I remember, kitten. You called it my Naugahyde ball. I also remember that you and Princess looked so grown up and ladylike that day.
Not that there's anything wrong with looking like kids.
Heck no. I still try to.
But you told us you never take money from a corporation for your balls.
I beg your pardon?
Ah, she means inaugural balls. Oh,
that's a relief.
Honey?
Yes, dear?
Sounds like you've got a teachable moment.
Yeah. Come here, kitten. Wow, you're so tall in your training heels. Now, honey, do you know what pragmatism means?
Sure. We studied that last year in our unit on the political philosophies of superheroes.
Well, then, as you know, it means having to adjust to changing realities.
Mm-hmm.
Last year's campaign was much more expensive than our first one. You know that.
Oh, I sure do. That's the excuse Mom gave for not getting a new pair of Uggs.
Well, we just felt it was unfair to our individual donors who gave so much to help us to ask them to give one more time.
Besides, so many of them were my executives anyway. It just seemed simpler to cut out the middlemen.
But, Daddy,
mm-hmm.
A couple of the boys at school say this proves you don't stand by your principles.
Tell them the rest, honey.
Well, their dads work for Goldman Sachs.
Well, two things. First, I don't want those boys paying for your lunch.
Uh-huh.
And second, I think Mr. Eric here may have a little surprise for you.
Can I call you kitten?
I guess.
Well, how about a dongle with the platinum version of our search engine on it? It'll give you results nobody else in your classes will be getting.
Wow, that sounds pretty cool.
And you know what else is cool, Captain?
What?
The principles are like mountains.
How's that?
Sometimes they look better when you get farther away from them.
More coffee, Mrs. President?
Well, I think we'd all like some, Manuelo.
Mm-hmm. Including our very grown-up kitten.
turning the tide, and the sky was a flare when he came up for air in his homemade fan blade, one man submarine ride.
Ladies and gentlemen, the new F-bomb, foreclosure. As you know, more than 400,000 people have had their homes foreclosed since the housing bubble in Florida burst 5 years ago. Now, for some, it's payback time. Hundreds of homeowners and condo associations are foreclosing on banks that have failed to pay dues and other expenses on the properties they repossessed. When banks foreclose on a home, they become responsible for paying fees to the homeowners association and all expenses going forward. In many cases, banks are failing to pay, leaving the associations short on cash. Now, homeowners groups are putting liens on the properties until the banks pay up and foreclosing on them if they don't. But in case you think that's the beginning of the turning of the wheel in the other direction, the New York Times, reports that regulators are close to settling with 14 banks whose foreclosure practices had ridden roughshod over borrowers and the rule of law. The deal has not yet been made official, but the initial report said borrowers who had lost their homes would receive a total of $3.75 billion. The numbers will tell you that if 10% of the 4.4 million borrowers who had foreclosure during this period were harmed, each would get roughly $8,500. That was a far cry from the possible penalties outlined last year by the federal regulators requiring the reviews that have been undertaken and have been stopped in the wake of the possible settlement. The one thing this story did not mention, however, is that one of the people who were conducting the reviews required in this process, the process that was short-circuited by the possible settlement, was an internal review, an independent review paid for by the banks, so you know how independent it was, of the practices to find if there was homeowner harm. One of the guys who was conducting, one of the reviewers hired by the private company, hired by the banks, wrote in a comment to NakedCapitalism.com his experience of what happened, which was, first of all, the homeowners were notified that they could apply for review only by direct mail to the homes that they were no longer in because they'd been foreclosed out of them. And then the process continued of supervisors telling him and his colleagues, who he says were highly qualified for the work, to ignore most of the harms they found, including the ones that involved, quote, issues of law. Ignore those. We're not lawyers, after all. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, continues to explode. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations or NPR worldwide throughout Europe. The USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. And it'd be just like knowing the legal justification for doing something illegal if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the Shoshak Poet to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii and Chicago in exile desks. The Twitter feed based on this program now has more than 79,000 followers. You could join them at The Harry Shearer. Everything in the store at harryshearer.com remains just $5 with free shipping. That's at harryshearer.com, where you can find the playlist for this broadcast and the email address for this broadcast. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates from the facilities of KCR. Oh, and thanks to Jenny Lawson, too, and Pam Halstead. Oh, comes from Santa Monica, the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.